Well, tonight our Coast to Coast ride will take us into the future. We're going on this ride with historian of the future, Charles Ostman. So we'll be back with Charles in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And get ready for this one tonight. Charles Ostman is a senior fellow at the Institute for Global Futures, serves with the management team of Fourth Venture. He's also an active participant with the Millennium Project for Global Future Studies and Research of the American Council for the United Nations University. Charles has more than 25 years' experience in the fields of electronics, material science, computing, and artificial intelligence, including 8 years at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley, and at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Back by popular demand, Charles Ostman. Hi, Charles. How are you?
Greetings, George, and I'm very glad to be here. And, you know, compared to the last time I was on the air, which was in a much more difficult circumstance, was during Katrina.
Yes.
This is a more pleasant circumstance, but I'm very happy to be here.
Hey, this story I had right before you came on about another virus, and they've got the date down to January 6th. How do they know it's going to happen? That confuses me.
Well, there's many different kinds of viruses, and I should point out that this is not exactly my specialty, but I certainly have had my own exposure of viruses and remedies and such. But there's something called a Trojan horse, and this is a very generic term, but it just basically means that viruses can, in fact, be set up to either be triggered by a time or a date or an event cue or some combination thereof. And sometimes, it gets very insidious because a lot of times these viruses are not designed to destroy, but rather to quietly lurk about and actually sniff for data and even, in a sense, hijack an entire system. So the good news is, if you want to call it that, that there's a clearly defined objective. I guess this is a destructive virus. And there's a time code or a date code that's stamped into it to turn it on at that point.
Okay, so do you have a crystal ball, Charles? Do you look into the future of technology?
No crystal balls, but I am paid to do this. I mean, a lot of people are. But I think in today's world, because of the complexity and also the pace and the interconnectedness of so many different areas that are all simultaneously and, in a sense, synergistically magnifying each other's pace of development or influence upon the world, that the enterprise of futurism, quote-unquote, has gone from something of a kind of an interesting silent to a very serious, very mission-critical kind of profession, and there's many people doing this now.
Are you almost like science fiction writers in that, you know, how they write about strange things in the future, and in some cases they come true? I keep thinking about the Jetsons and Dick Tracy and, you know, the comics and the Jetson television show.
Or Star Trek.
In Star Trek as well.
Yeah,
all
sure.
That kind of technology that was put in those films, comics, TV shows years ago have come true. How do writers like that look into the future, like you do, and start making projections of what some of these trends are going to be?
Well, the one thing about science fiction writing, and I've never been a science fiction author, I should point out, I've written lots of technical papers, but I've never done any fiction. But friends of mine are science fiction authors, and they actually approach me and say, Charles, what do you think of this? And we talk about it. But here's the basic idea. Science fiction authors, for the most part, tend to be pretty smart folks in the sense that they're not only good storytellers, but they also have a reasonable background in science in general. And then they know who to ask and, you know, what kinds of questions to probe for. But one example of this, which I think is particularly prolific, if I may, is the film that came out back in 59 or 60 called Forbidden Planet. And this was perhaps one of the greatest examples of science fiction being used not just as a platform to explore new ideas, but also to explore things that were socially controversial, but present them in a way that could be safe for the censors of the time, as it were, but still get to the general public these ideas. And what made Forbidden Planet so interesting, you know, forget Robbie the Robot and all that sort of nonsense, but the core of it was they brought together the concept of nanotechnology, consciousness that could be manifest in the physical form, and perhaps the most dangerous aspects of how those two fit together, which in terms of the movie was Monsters of the Id, that is, people's thoughts and inner subconscious sort of psyche, as it were, suddenly became manifest, and that was the undoing of this mythical civilization called the Krell. And these were very far-out topics. I mean, things that could only be, you know, nudged upon by maybe the most kind of theoretical visual, you know, the philosophers and such. And yet this was a film that, for an entertainment vehicle, brought these ideas to the general public. I mean, it was a real milestone in this kind of thinking.
Yeah, Charles, they are now implanting human brain cells in mice. And they're saying, hey, not to worry, you know, even if it's got 0.1% of the human brain cells in their brain, don't worry, they're not going to turn into human rodents. But I think this is dangerous. I think technology can go too far, can it?
Well, it can, it can. And forgive me, I've just gotten over like a week worth of flu, so if I sound a little craggy, it's because I am, basically. But I'm hanging there. I've got my cup of tea here.
Sure, yeah, you sound fine.
Thank you so much. In fact, it's kind of funny because you kept talking about flu shots and that kind of thing, and I've never had a flu shot, at least not for like the past 15 years.
So. Welcome to the club.
Indeed so. Although in my earlier days when I did a lot of traveling in the tropics, I would take tropical disease shots, that kind of thing. But anyway, back to the topic at hand. People have to realize this, that the whole world of recombinant proteomics and sort of the ability to cut and paste genetic properties, this has become a rote science. So whether or not a person approves of the idea, that could be a debate, but it's already here. So, and sometimes I'm going to offer statements which I'm sure will be controversial, and people who call in will want to rant and rave.
Sure.
But I try to deal with the reality of things. It's my job as a professional due diligence person that looks at technologies from a patent perspective, as a person that advises all these different agencies about what the future is from their perspective, I have to stay on point with things that are here and things that will have real actual implications and not get too caught up in the philosophy of whether it's right or wrong. So I have to kind of wear two separate hats. But it should be pointed out that if one has the interest to yank out of a particular organism, be a plant or an animal, and then insert that into some other organism, if they have the money and the interest to do it, it'll be done. And whether or not it happens in this country or somewhere else, that's really the question mark, because in a sense we're living in a global environment.
But it could be dangerous, though.
Oh, certainly could be dangerous. I mean, almost everything that we do can be dangerous. I mean, nanotechnology itself, which is, I'm sure we'll be talking about eventually, can be one of the most spectacular breakthroughs in history in terms
sure.
of how it changes energy, medicine, manufacturing, et cetera. But it could also be the most horrible weapon ever invented. I mean, that's just the nature of things. And I think if I were to toss out a philosophical idea, it's part of our spiritual maturity index, if I can use that set of words, to determine if we actually have the ability to manage these things in an appropriate way. The fact that these things exist is not a point of debate. It's our maturity to understand what they are and hopefully use them in a wise way. That's what the real challenge is.
Well, last hour, Charles, we were talking about these RFID chips that they're putting in pets and they're putting them in inventory and merchandise. And eventually they're going to put it in people, too.
If They already are.
Exactly. It's like 60 people with these already.
More than 60, actually.
This is growing, really?
Yeah, very, very fast. Let me explain. The patents for these things go back well over 15 years. I know. I've read them myself. I have them right here.
Oh.
In fact, the Air Force explored this going back to the late 80s, really to monitor pilots, that kind of thing. And then NASA picked up on this in the early 90s, obviously for monitoring the physiology of astronauts when they're in space. But the Verichip folks picked up on this in the mid-90s. I've actually communicated with them several times. And just as a kind of a snapshot, it's not the technology. The technology's already here. It's a rote. I mean, Catherine Albrecht's done a great job in trying to make this a public issue, which I commend her for. But this is old news. The only thing that's going to change, really, is the way that the political acceptedness of this is going to be brought to the public world. But as a kind of a suggestion for this, this is how this process tends to work, since I was listening earlier. In the April 97 issue of Time magazine, I actually have a copy of it. People can do an archive and search. They had an entire centerfold issue, article, several pages long, talking about how complex life is. They showed tax forms. They showed credit cards. They showed, you know, driver's ID and all this kind of stuff, and said, wouldn't it be wonderful if this could all be compressed into one single, you know, carryable thing, and then the next stage would be a chip. You know, this was like 8 years ago, and this was being, of course, pushed by banks, insurance companies, anybody to do with sort of human interaction, you know, healthcare, all that kind of stuff. And so here we are several years later. This stuff's now being sort of floated out there to the public. And she was mentioning IBM, and I'm quite familiar with IBM, by the way. I've done some work with these folks in the past. They actually had a television commercial, I think about 3 or 4 years ago, and they show a guy going into a store, and he's kind of walking around, looks kind of scruffy like me with a beard and hair and everything. And the guy's walking out the door, and a security guy kind of chases after him. You think, aha, he's going to be picked up for shoplifting. And the security guard says, oops, you forgot your receipt. The point being that this was an ad that IBM was trying to float to the public 3.5-4 years ago to suggest that when you walk into a store, the store knows it's you. When you touch a product on the shelf, the product itself instantaneously registers that you've communicated with it and transacts the exchange of fiduciary value for that product. In other words, there's no cash register, no credit card, nothing. It's just your presence and the products, and there you are. And in fact, in Hollywood, if you saw the film Minority Report, they showed multiple scenes, in this case with retina scan, but, you know, very same idea, that everybody's connected to everything. In fact, there's a term for this called ubiquitous computing. I've actually sat in a couple of ubiquitous computing conferences and gave talks. So, I mean, all this kind of stuff where the people want to commoditize the exchange of existence as a kind of a deliverable. In other words, every time you transact your presence somewhere, it's in a constant, real-time, fully immersive environment. The stuff, the pieces to make that possible are already sort of there. It's really just a matter of combining them, and more importantly, to get policy shaped in such a way that it becomes acceptable and becomes the norm. That's the last barrier, but that sort of is where we're at now.
But on the face of it, Charles, and you're right, it sounds exciting, it sounds convenient.
Well, I'm not supporting this, sir. I'm just saying this is what...
No, I know, but my point is in the wrong hands, what could happen with this kind of technology?
It could be very bad because, as Catherine so correctly pointed out, this is the last stage of freedom as we sort of know it. And, you know, I have a lot of friends that belong to different organizations, and they talk about privacy as we know it is no longer going to exist in 20 years or something. And they may be right. I mean, maybe we're clinging to a sort of anachronistic concept of what freedom had once been. If you go backwards, say, 50 or even 100 years, when most people lived out in the farm or on a ranch or something, and people could own their own guns and kind of sort of, I don't know, control their own destiny to a certain point, you didn't have any of this stuff at all. And people's privacy really was as it was. It was sort of an organic process. And because of the complexity of the world we live in, the requirement to become ever more connected to a real-time, ubiquitous, data-based system, you can't really function in today's world without that as being part of the process. And the Internet kind of pushes along rather quickly because, as you well know, everything now is online. No matter what it is, even if you don't have a computer yourself, every time you use an ATM or if you do any kind of transaction, pay your bills, whatever it is, it's all part of a B2B Internet infrastructure where everything is in transit in real time anyway. So the last stage of that process is the interface between the actual person and this sort of invisible virtual system. So by eliminating that last sort of interface noise, if you will, so that the whole process becomes automated, that's kind of what the last stage really is.
Well, this technology is exciting, and what I would like to do when we talk about nanotechnology, when we get through the half-hour point this hour, is also, by the end of tonight, Charles, I'd like for you to make some technology predictions for us. And maybe put them out there in stages, maybe what you see in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and just take some guesses. We'll put it in the old coast-to-coast time capsule and see what happens in all this. What's fueling the speed of all this? Is it the computer that's getting all this done?
The computer is a piece, and there's something called the NBIC, or NBIC conference. I've spoken at one of these, and that means the Nano Info Bio Cognotech Convergence Conference, and this sounds crazy, but this is an NSF-sponsored event. This is a very serious, you know, very top-level Nobel Prize laureate folks get together and have this event every year. And actually, it's chaired by Mihail Rocha, who actually chairs the National Nanotechnology Initiative. So, I mean, this is a very serious attempt to take a kind of a holographic view as to how all these different, seemingly separate, but in fact very interrelated realms synergistically accelerate the whole sort of operational ecology, as I call it. So even though the computer is a piece of the puzzle, it's only a piece. It's an entire puzzle that is magnifying this process as we speak. And part of this has to do with material science. I mean, I guess I'll just fast forward a little bit. A lot of my computer science friends, we used to debate about this 10, 12, 15 years ago, and I would say, well, they would talk to me about different kinds of operating systems and different kinds of architectures and MIMD versus SIMD and all this kind of stuff. And I would say, well, that's interesting, but actually it's a material science problem. And they'd go, what? And they would describe, you know, yell at me. But here's the reason I say this. Here's the reason I say this is because we're now approaching a world that says we can begin to mix and match biology with computing. We can mix organic systems with inorganic systems. We can put together different kinds of components that behave differently, but as a system create a kind of a collective organism that goes far beyond what computing was, say, even 20 years ago. And it's not just, you know, how fast is the machine. That's kind of a false way of measuring that. What you're really looking for are systems that can evolve, that are adaptive, that can respond to the surrounding stimuli, and just like a living thing, will continue to grow and on their own accord autonomously begin to develop their own strategies. And this process, by the way, is called evolutionary computing, and it's been around for a number of years. But what's interesting is, in the last handful of years, the ability to make this a much more commercially interesting thing to do is because the nanotechnology provides a new kind of material system to make these systems much more easily manufacturable and replicatable. And in fact, you will see easily within 5 to 7 years, neural networks and things that behave biologically embedded in just about everything you can imagine, whether it's appliances or your car, or, and certainly in today's world, if you look at very large-scale, complex, nonlinear systems like risk analysis, financial forecasting, certainly in the military world, you know, battlefield simulations, that kind of thing, it's all done with this evolutionary computing paradigm as the core driver. It's no longer just a bunch of folks sitting around typing up code. It's really these systems that, on their own, kind of self-adapt and self-organize. And that's really the heart of this new paradigm.
I think, for example, the National Hurricane Center sits down now, and as they do their forecasting for next year, they use computer models, and they were off this year because they didn't think we'd have a record-setting tornado year.
There's a story about this, which is interesting. In fact, the last time we were on the air, we kind of brushed up against this. The India Times Daily published an article where their top computer scientists and their top meteorology people said, look, we've been running these models for years. We, you know, we're pretty good at this, but all of a sudden our models are not working. And they tried really hard to explain this, and they got so frustrated they actually published a letter to the outside world saying, if anyone has any handles on this, please talk to us because we need to know what's going on. And their perspective, this was from their from India, was that they felt convinced that there was some kind of external control or the weather is being, you know, somehow manipulated. This is a published article. In fact, people can go to indiatimesdaily.com and look for the article. It's last year, about maybe 14 months ago, I think. But the basic idea is that you're right. The computer models that are used to digest and sort of forecast these systems really come from an earlier era where the first sort of supercomputing models that specialize in nonlinear systems were really for nuclear blast simulations. That was a big deal. It was a way to simulate a nuclear event without having to actually blow up a bomb. I mean, for obvious reasons, this was considered to be a big deal. But because that process had been so thoroughly sort of diagnosed and converted into a doable thing, then that same technique could then be applied to other things, like weather, as an example.
Well, I tell you, what we're going to talk about tonight will affect everybody, men, women, children, animals, plants, you name it.
And new life forms.
Absolutely, and we'll talk about what some of those new life forms will be. What are you doing these days, Charles?
Well, some of it I can talk about and some of it I can't. I'm sorry. But the things that I can talk about are interesting. And the things that motivate me or that I'm so excited about, one thing I'm really, really fond of doing is doing what I call swords to plowshares. That is, working with technologies that were specifically and exclusively for the military and now converting them to peaceful applications. And if I can offer a tiny little plug, I work with this group called Fourth Venture Group, and that's what we're doing. We're actually working with Russian military people from the major military labs and taking similar technology and then converting it to civilian use here and in a developing world. And in fact, their first product, which will be here in Berkeley in about 3 months, is a Russian wind turbine system, you know, for windmills. And our plan is to actually sort of take their core design and remodify it using carbon nanofiber reinforced plastics and so forth, and make a really ultimate wind system that can be deployed anywhere in the world. And this comes straight out of the Makiev State Rocket Facility, which is like one of their top secret labs until a couple of years ago.
My friend owns a small company here in St. Louis, and I've known him for years. He took it public, and now he's making carbon fiber windmills and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing that's so interesting about nanotech. Some people get kind of concerned about gray goo when they read stories about, you know, Michael Crichton's prey and all that kind of thing. And that's great for science fiction, maybe in the distant future. But today, here, this moment, nanotechnology as a material system is so interesting because it allows one to approach seemingly impossible or very expensive engineering problems in a much more effective way.
We'll be right back, Charles. And also, maybe I can bend your arm a little bit to get you to talk about what you can't talk about. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed. Hey, by the way, the January issue of the After Dark newsletter is going to be on psychics, intuitives, remote viewers. It is phenomenal. Ed Dames, Glynis McCants, Glenn Kimball, Sean David Morton, and others, Dr. Turi. So if you want to pick up that After Dark newsletter, go ahead. That's the January issue. And yes, you still have a few more weeks left to get the free CD on exorcisms, the interview with the late Father Malachi Martin, and Art Bell classic called Perfect Possession. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Now, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Charles Ospin, our guest. Charles, most people know what nanotechnology means. However, we do have new viewers and new listeners all the time looking at our website. Give me a definition of nanotechnology.
Sure, I'll give you my definition, which, I mean, it's a complex and diverse topic, but my favorite Occam's razor approach, as it were, is it's the ability to manipulate matter at the atomic or molecular scale of interaction. That is the ability to move individual atoms or molecules around to very precise patterns or ways to get these atoms and molecules to construct themselves into some kind of larger object of interest, as opposed to traditional, say, solution-based chemistry, where you might mix a couple of reagents together and catalyze a reaction, out the other end comes a new compound. In the case of nanotechnology, you're going one step further. You're actually able to manipulate the individual molecules or atoms to make something hopefully of interest, a device or a membrane or some kind of a structure, whatever it might be.
How did someone, some scientist somewhere, first discover the ability for nanotechnology? How did that happen?
Well, Richard Feynman, of course, made a very famous talk back in 59 where he talked about there's a lot of room at the bottom, suggesting that if we could ever figure out what nature does, basically, there's an enormous amount of opportunity to kind of move things around and get things to form up in ways that they normally don't do. But it wasn't until maybe 25, 30 years later that people, perhaps in my background in material science, began to really look at this and say, well, can we actually do this? And again, it's important to point out that it's not a single science. It's not a single narrowly defined anything, really. It's really a combination of a wide variety of different occupations, biochemistry, different kinds of sort of organically based sciences, as well as material science and physics and chemistry. It's all sort of mixed together. And what makes it so exciting is that, you know, I'll give you an example. Engineers, back in the days when I was an engineer, sort of, we were confined to the materials and the fabrication process that were available. Whatever our engineering dreams were, we had to sort of put them into a little box by the stuff that was available at the time. Now technology, in a sense, kind of reverses that. Now we can dream of all kinds of crazy things, no matter how far out they sound, and in a sense actually invent the material and or the molecular structure to make it possible. That's the real power of nanotechnology, to have that kind of a handle. And, excuse me, of course, in today's world, because biology is so robust and has been doing it for billions of years, our first real approach, of course, is to kind of look at organic systems and then begin to kind of nibble away at understanding how those things work. But eventually, this will begin to drift into the inorganic world as well. In fact, that's kind of where nanotech will ultimately go, is where those two worlds get mixed together.
With nanotechnology, it's not just then the minuteness, the size of this technology
that's
important. Right?
It's the process. And this is where it gets kind of confusing, because if you read different technical trade journals or different institutions who specialize in certain areas, like integrated circuit manufacturer or something, they'll harp on the idea that it has to be a certain size to justify being called, you know, nanoscience. However, from my perspective, and, you know, I'll happily defend my argument here, I think the real game plan is not just how small can you make something, it's really how the thing is made. I mean, for instance, a redwood tree or a whale, these are huge things, right? But the actual process that made those things possible was at the molecular level inside of each living cell. There are a series of little machine-like components called organelles, which constantly break apart and reassemble molecules to satisfy the physiological requirements of the larger organism. So in a rough kind of way, that's what we're hoping to do now. We're trying to borrow from that process to say, can we rearrange atoms and molecules in a very precise way to make things like integrated circuits or, say, fuel cells for cars or devices that can store hydrogen in a solid-state medium or just, you know, medical devices, et cetera, that don't have to require a gigantically enormous and complicated manufacturing process to make those things possible.
With this technology, without a question, make our lives easier in the future, all of us, people in their homes, wherever we might be.
I certainly hope so, and this is why I'm so intrigued by this, because if you look at the world's problems, starting with energy, that's the very top of the list, in my opinion, and then you're going to be looking at things like access to water, the quality of our air being polluted, you know, all these basic things, which sadly are being so severely challenged as we speak. The one common answer I can see to get at all these things simultaneously is this approach to manufacturing, that is the ability to make things. You know, for instance, not to get political, it's not really my thing, but if you just step backwards for a second, look at the Iraq war in its current state. We're probably going to spend something like $500 billion, I think, when all is said and done. And hopefully everything works out, and I wish the best for all that. But my point being, you know, $500 billion, it's almost mind-boggling to try to figure out how much money that really is. Do you realize that all of our current alternative energy programs here in this country, whether it be biofuels, solar, wind, mm-hmm. all the different kinds of experimental things, right. Hydrogen coming from biological sources, all that kind of stuff, is less than a week of our current sort of activities in Iraq. My sense of it is that what we should really be doing is going after almost like an Apollo moon program style of approach. We should make it an absolute, all-out, no-holds-barred, you know, everything we can possibly do to get out of our dependency on, especially, you know, foreign-based petrochemicals as our single and only sort of energy source. This is suicide. And in fact, if you look at the rest of the world, China, India, Japan, et cetera, they are doing this. I mean, they are pushing the envelope very hard. And in fact, the number one publisher of scientific papers in nanotechnology is China, not here. And much of that research is going directly into energy-related applications. I mean, the rest of the world kind of gets this. And again, not to be political, I'm just saying we should really be taking a second and third look at our priorities, because even if we don't do it, the rest of the world's going to do it. And I would like to see us somehow stay, you know, at the leading edge of this, as opposed to, you know, like following what the rest of the world has already done. And there's a lot to be said for that.
Well, there's just too many greedy people out there, Charles, that are making lots of money on the kinds of fuels that are available to us right now. I don't even call it fossil fuels anymore, because I believe it's abiotic and that this planet makes it. But the point is, you're absolutely right. It's primarily being produced and taken out of foreign countries. And, you know, that's a stranglehold on us.
It's a stranglehold. And by the way, speaking of abiotic fuels, I'm kind of on the fence about this, but I've been studying a lot, and so I'm open to the idea. But in Business 2.0, which is a major publication, it's kind of like Forbes and Wired magazine sort of crossed together, they just published an article called Ending the End of Oil. And they don't mention abiotic oil by name, but in the middle of this article, they harp on super deep offshore drilling, where they talk about going 5 miles and deeper into the Earth's crust. So I suggest to you, there's no geological evidence on the planet, no model that can even begin to suggest how anything from an organic source could be 5 miles down.
Exactly.
So I'm thinking, you know, there's something to be, I mean, when Business 2.0 publishes this in English, you know, here, that says that a lot of folks, even if the oil companies don't want to make it publicly sort of their proclamation, a lot of folks are catching on to this idea. So I think there's something to be said for that.
Well, Jerry Corsi in his book, Black Gold Stranglehold, he must be jumping up and down if he's listening to the show right now.
Because, well, I hope he is.
You know, that's his theory. The nanotechnology in various areas of industry that affect all of us, you know, our homes, what we do, our work, our play, are there various segments where it's going to really become noticeable first and foremost, maybe in the medical field?
I was going to say medical, medical is certainly one of them, and actually this whole ubiquitous computing thing is another, not to get back to Catherine Albrecht and that whole thing, but look, I mean, the whole RFID thing is already here. And the thing that makes that possible or doable is the fact that we can now, so I'll give a couple examples.
All right.
There's a manufacturing process called roll-to-roll. It's basically printing with chemistry. And what I mean by this is that instead of having to, like, etch a circuit in silicon and go through that whole complicated process in a much simpler and cheaper way, you can now print pretty complicated chemistry systems onto all kinds of materials, plastics, different kinds of metal foils, you know, you name it. So that the actual cost of these devices that you slap onto your products or that you embed into the walls or you make your your car smart, all that kind of stuff, all those sort of sensory systems and transponding systems, the actual cost per unit becomes so small that you truly can have this ubiquitous transceiving environment. So I would say in the next 5 to 7 years, roughly, you really are going to be in a world where everything is intelligent and it's all ubiquitously interconnected. And you may not notice it in your daily life, but trust me, it'll be sort of there in the background. And it'll be slowly but surely, and probably fairly quickly, actually, woven into our daily lives in a way that nobody's going to be offended by it necessarily, but it'll be there.
I think we're going to, you know, they've got the cell phones out there now that are pretty thin with batteries, you know, the size of paper pretty soon. I think cell phones, for example, may be, you know, almost the size of a credit card in terms of thickness. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And a couple of quick thoughts here. If you talk about wireless technology, for instance, changing a culture, and I work with a couple of organizations that are very specifically oriented towards bringing technology to the so-called developing world. The big thing right now is to get wireless everywhere. And I'm talking about out in the bush in Africa or in the hills of Pakistan or just anywhere. You know, I've been to Brazil several times, and I sort of saw some of the first wireless installations there. And the idea is that even the most remote part of the earth, when, say, tribes or sort of, you know, cultural units in their autonomous areas, suddenly can go wireless. They can communicate with anybody on the planet. And this has such a dramatic change on how they live, how they work, how they commoditize their products, whether they're trying to sell, you know, agricultural goods or something. And the change is so instantaneous within a handful of years. People who have been completely isolated from the outside world actually become sort of part of it. And this is a cultural phenomenon that's never happened before in history. So, I mean, it's a really interesting moment to watch this happening as we speak. And the beginning edge of that is the cell phone. And what you see on, say, the savannah lands or something, is you'll see solar-operated transponder systems, like the repeater towers, that don't require any kind of wiring or nothing at all. And yet the cell phones cost, you know, a few dollars, and they're handed out to the local folks, and within a matter of weeks or a month at most, everybody, even the most remote bush tribe, now has cell phones everywhere. So it's completely changed. I'm serious. It's funny, but it's really true. So to kind of change how things like healthcare is dealt with, for instance, one of the things I'm particularly interested in, excuse me, is this idea of what's called a lab and a chip. Sorry.
A lab and a chip?
Yeah, what a lab is and that? A chip. And what that means is, forgive me if it gets a little in detail, but I just want to give a background. A laboratory really consists of the following thing. You have fluidics. You have electromechanical devices, you know, valves and switches, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You might have some optics in case you're looking for a certain kind of marker or the indicator of some biopathogen or whatever. And, you know, you have kind of a bunch of different kinds of lab equipment, but shrunk down to something the size of a credit card. And nowadays, because of, again, these modern fabrication processes, these things can be disposable. You could have a complete diagnostic system for major diseases like malaria or, you know, Hunter's fever or something, whatever it might be. And you can run a test. And that can be hooked up to a wireless device like a cell phone. And, you know, the hospital or the place where the data is analyzed could be 1,000 miles away. But somebody could be in the field, plug in one of these little diagnostic devices, these lab and chip systems, and take a sample of blood or some other material. And within a matter of minutes, have a complete diagnosis and say, aha, this is what the disease is, this is what you have. And then have a treatment dispensed wirelessly to that spot. This is exactly what's being worked on as we speak.
How will nanotechnology make our living environment a little more comfortable?
I'm sorry, living environment?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, gosh, I think environmental control in terms of air, temperature, humidity, that kind of thing is probably the first, because if you look at the cost in terms of energy for air conditioning, that kind of thing, or just, you know, maintaining temperature and so forth in a house, winter versus summer, et cetera, that's an enormous piece of the energy puzzle. I mean, you'd be astonished if you knew how much of the power grid is consumed by that alone. And yet smart materials, smart building materials can dramatically change this. And then at the same time, if we can change how we illuminate our homes, that is the kind of light we use. And of course, you probably remember there was a time not too long ago when the first fluorescents, these little screw-in fluorescent bulbs came out. That was a big deal. Well, the next thing that's coming around the corner are screw-in LEDs. In fact, I think one of your sponsors, C. Crane, has these things right now, but you're going to see them a lot cheaper in the next 4 to 5 years, again, because nanomaterials can make the manufacture of these LED things very inexpensive, so that the average person, if they, let's say, change all their incandescent bulbs to LEDs, they would have like 1/10 or less the actual power consumption just to light up their house. So, I mean, these are the kind of things that are going to dramatically change the cost of what it takes to maintain quality of life as it's currently understood.
Will nanotechnology be in robotics? I mean, will every house have a robot, for example?
You know, it's kind of Hans Moravec, who's kind of like the world-famous robotics fellow from Stanford, you know, he wrote a bunch of books and talked about how every house would have a smart Robbie the Robot kind of character, you know, in their house by the year 2000 or whatever. Now, sadly, we haven't quite gotten there yet. But I think eventually we're going to get there. And actually, the people who are pushing this are the Japanese. Excuse me. And there's a reason for this. In Japan, as much of the sort of industrial world is doing now, their population is graying. I mean, the actual child per family, or however you want to measure that, is less than one. In fact, there's a huge debate going on because various parts of Europe and even the U.S., a lot of people aren't having large families anymore. So they're concerned about who's going to take care of people when they get older. How are they going to deal with, you know, running a household, doing the daily chores, that kind of thing, if you don't have the traditional family model. So in Japan, there's been a really strong push to get robotics into the house so that the houses are kind of intelligent systems where the amount of physical labor required by the people is a lot less because the people are becoming older and there's not enough new people to come up and be part of the family system.
Well, you know, now they have robots that vacuum for you.
That's right.
These little round things, and they go scurrying all over the place, and they're getting better and better and better. And this is, of course, with small computer-type chips. Once nanotechnology is applied to these things, Charles, I mean, they're going to go all over the place.
Well, and here's one of the major breakthroughs, getting back to material science one more time. If we could get back to the world of evolutionary computing and neural networks and things that look and behave like a biological system, that's where the nanotech suddenly really becomes interesting because in today's world, and again, sorry if it gets a little technical, but there's this reconfigurable computing paradigm which requires a certain kind of chipset to make that possible. Unfortunately, the amount of silicon in manufacturing traditional ways would take a lot of silicon to make even a really simple little thing like the brain of a salamander. However, if you went to nanotech as an approach to manufacture these kinds of reconfigurable chips, all of a sudden you can, by several orders of magnitude, increase the gate complexity of these systems. And in fact, if you look at Hewlett-Packard and Stan Williams and his group there, this is exactly what they're doing. They're precisely aiming at being able to create these sort of nanoscale intersect points where they have switchable molecules in between each cross point where these nanowires come together. And they can now create, you know, billions of gates on a piece of material that would only hold, say, a few million gates by current standards. And when that becomes a commercially manufacturable thing, and I would say they're 3 to 5 years away, and other companies are going to be doing this as well, then the whole point is you really can have a smart brain in your gadget, whatever it is, because the cost of making the brain is so small, and more importantly, these systems are designed to be self-learning and adaptive, and that's really what's going to be a major shift, because instead of having to program everything from scratch, you let the system kind of run around, and it trains itself and becomes smart as it's exposed to its environment. And that's exactly where this is going.
What's the downside of nanotechnology, Charles? It can't be all great, huh?
This is more of an Art Bell talk, but yes. I mean, I've gone through this many times. The two areas that I'm personally nervous about, one's called proteomic targeting, and the other one's what I would call a certain kind of selective disassembly. Selective disassembly suggests that, remember in the film Andromeda Strain, for those that may know, this also came out in 63 or 64. We're talking about science fiction again. But they had the concept right. And in fact, in the very beginning of the film, if you may recall, it showed a scene of a jet pilot flying around in his plane. And then all of a sudden, the plane starts to dissolve, or at least parts of the plane. The mask and then the window and the cockpit and everything. Now, the reason was because of an organism from outer space that, you know, had these very interesting properties. But they were kind of right in the sense that there are people who theoretically visualize a military scenario where you could release this cloud of nanites, I'm sorry to put it in this context, that could selectively target a specific material, like, say, rubber hoses or gaskets or other organically based materials that might be part of the mission-critical system of a tank, let's say, or even a plane. I mean, it sounds interesting, but the problem, of course, obviously, is if you're going to hatch something like that, how do you get it to stop doing what it's doing once it's disabled the thing in question? And more importantly, if it's a pseudo-life form of some kind, clearly it has the potential to mutate and do something you didn't expect. That's certainly one area. The other area called proteomic targeting suggests...
Yeah, hold that for next hour.
Right,
we'll do that right at the top. We shall be right back with you, Charles Ostman, and we'll get into your predictions, too, on Coast to Coast AM.